Welcome, everyone, and welcome to The Journey Home with Bruce Roth and Lynn Johnson. And we're talking about the book called The Journey Home. And it's based on the Obstacles to Peace from A Course in Miracles. And it's written by our dear friend Ken Wapnick. And last week we didn't get the recording, so we're starting from where we were before. We've gone back in time.
And it bears repeating, because what we read was packed.
Yes, exactly. So we go back, let's see, I am actually looking at where we were reading the passage from the text that starts with the ego always speaks first. Is
that's
that about right?
Where I've got to. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Well, you want to read? And
Sure.
We'll go back.
Yeah, on the middle... Little page 10, he's quoting from the text, chapter 6, section 4, several places, and strings them together and says, "The ego always speaks first." First, I can say that. It is capricious and does not mean its maker, in brackets, the decision maker, in bracket. Well, so it's kind of a little awkward to read those, you know, quoted things and the bracket things, but that's... That's Ken's commentary about the decision maker. I'll start that first sentence over again. The ego, first couple sentences. The ego all speaks first. It is capricious and does not mean its maker, open bracket, the decision maker, close bracket. Well, it believes incorrectly and correctly that its maker may withdraw its support from it at any moment. The ego does not regard itself as part of you, open bracket, the Christ, close bracket. Herein lies its primary error, the foundation of its whole thought system. When God created you, open bracket, Christ, close bracket, it's a little awkward to read it that way, but it's kind of fun. He made you part of him. That is why attack within the kingdom is impossible. You, open bracket, the decision-making part of the split mind, close bracket, made the ego without love, and so it does not love you. So, basically saying the ego is kind of a loveless thing, to say the least. You could not remain within the kingdom without love, since the kingdom is love. And since the kingdom is love, you believe that you are without it. We've hoodwinked ourselves here in this regard, haven't we?
Yeah, let's stop a minute and talk about that particular... You cannot remain within the kingdom without love. And since the kingdom is love, you believe you are without it. That says a lot. That says exactly what exactly is going on in our minds, is that we honestly believe that we are in a loveless place. You know, we found love in a hopeless place, and we think that we are in a loveless place, and therefore... we're without, and everything we see reflects that I'm missing this, I'm missing that, and it makes me think of today's lesson, which is, you know, basically you're supposed to look around at everything and say, you know, pretty basically, my thoughts don't mean anything about this, and
we're upset because we see a meaningless world.
Yeah, I'm upset because I see a meaningless world. I see a world that was made without love. It is upsetting, and I just wanted to stop there and talk about that particular line, because it really explains
everything.
We perceive as a problem. Everything, yeah. You know, I think there's no love, and therefore I'm not in heaven.
Uh-huh.
Pretty simply it. So we'll go ahead and continue reading.
Thank you for that. Clarification, because I think that really is important, because, you know, we really truly believe that we're in a loveless place, and that kind of ties into something else that is one of those things that we just take for granted in this world, is we believe we can lose those we love, and, you know, on the level of form that seems to be, you know, obvious. But in the level of the mind, it's like, well, wait a minute. How could that be possible if the ones that you love are in your mind and you take them with you wherever you go? And you never have gone anywhere.
Yes.
But anyway, yes. Or maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves.
No, that's a huge, I mean, really something to consider, because the concept or the knowing that whatever is here is in my mind, whatever I perceive is in my mind. And so, you know, bringing it back to the mind, that decision maker that Ken talks about all the time, really is essential. I mean, it's, you can't do this work without doing that. So I love it. Okay, so anyway, continue reading.
Okay. I'll read that sentence again. You could not remain within the kingdom without love, and since the kingdom is love, you believe that you are without it. This enables the ego to regard itself as separate and outside its maker, thus speaking for the part of your mind that believes you are separate and outside the mind of God. The ego then raised the first question that was ever asked, but one it can never answer. That question, what are you, was the beginning of doubt. The ego has never answered any questions since, although it has raised a great many. The most inventive activities of the ego have never done more than obscure the question, because you, open bracket, the decision maker, close bracket, have the answer, and the ego is afraid of you. Basically, the ego is afraid of the decision maker, isn't it? I mean, it's afraid of the mind's ability to choose against its non-existent SSSS.
Yes.
Silly, seemingly separate self.
and it's because the ego believes that that's the end of it, which it is. And you know, its goal, like any other thing, its goal is to survive. And so,
right.
You know, if it's not going to survive and you're the one who's willing it to, you know, go away, then it's going to attack you. That's just the way it is. But because we made it, then we're the one that gave it that ability. You know, I made you so that you can hurt me. Wow, what a great effect. And yet, if I recognized that I was the one who made it, then I could stop believing in it, and it would stop existing. And so the great effect would be over. And, you know, there's... You know, you'll say, there's a little part of me that really still just wants to stay here and have fun and eat chocolate and you know, love babies. And there's a little part of me that really still wants that. Well, guess what? That little part of it, you, is not your friend.
Yeah, and the love would be in heavy air quotes, too, because that the true appreciation and the true respect and I mean reverie that's not contingent on time or space or anything, you know, if you will, you know, the revelation, I guess, as the Course would put it, has nothing to do with the ego's definition of love, which is really more of infatuation and it's essentially a special of special hate mix. It always involves some kind of loss, some kind of separation, some kind of specialness, and we're told early in the text that, you know, all of our real kindnesses and our experiences of true beauty, eternal nature, have never left us, and that they're kept in safekeeping in our mind for us to return to whenever we're ready. So that's kind of nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. In fact,
yeah.
because we have to remember that we are living in a pretend world, and mm-hmm. that what we are pretending is something that we think we want or think we like or think we need or think is helpful or think is good or, you know, whatever it is, we're pretending about it. And so just, you know, recognizing that I could see peace instead of this.
We could have a true, unchanging love experience rather than an ephemeral, fake love experience, and that's the whole point. And obviously, we don't really even have a even a glimpse, really, of what that real love experience is, because our identity is so fixated on form and so entrenched in the dream of space-time. But we get little shadows of reflections of glimpses of things like that. And I think that's what has drawn us to this study and practice, because we know that there's something more, as just as Helen and Bill asked each other, it's got to be a better way here than this constant attack, defense, fear, cycle, and condemnation. It's just there's got to be a better way to do it than this, right? And I think we all intuitively sense that, and that's why we just need to question what doesn't work. And if we continue questioning it without condemnation enough, and train our mind to question that in every moment, ultimately, then at some point, as the Course says, God will take the final step, and we will see that we never left. But that's why we're in process. We're all in a state of transition, in a equivocating phase where we appear to be going back and forth between saner moments and those that are starkly insane. And so we need to be really patient with ourselves and just kind of watch when we go there and just say, oh, I must have been afraid of the peace that's beyond the ego's, crumbs. I want the real feast rather than the stale leftover scraps. And it's a culinary metaphor for a moment there.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to me because how would I even know that? How would I in my regular life know that if I didn't have something like A Course in Miracles explaining it to me? I would just go through my life thinking things are the way they're supposed to be, and not even recognizing that throughout my life I'm the one who've made up all the definitions of everything. That's again what our lesson today is. I'm the one that gave meaning to everything that I see, and the meaning that I give to it is different than the meaning you give to it. My child is more important to me than your child. Because of the personalness of the attachment that we have to things, to these thoughts. And so really it's being just willing to look objectively. Honestly, just look objectively at what is happening and asking yourself these questions. And I talked about Byron Katie before. Is this true? And it goes along so well with these lessons, because every time you look at something and say, that there should be a different political situation going on in the world. Is that true? I don't know. How would I know?
I think one of her four questions is, I think three are about, the truth. And
yeah.
And one of them is, how do I know it's the truth, how can I be certain it's the truth?
Yeah.
And from the perspective of the ego, we can't. We can't know anything. And that's what that first sentence in that paragraph I'm almost finished with says. It says, you cannot understand conflict until you fully understand the basic fact that the ego cannot know anything. And knowing is really in the sense of really truly appreciating and understand. And so, the true appreciation, understanding, respect, admiration, if you will, that really only happens outside of the dream of space-time. But there's a part of our mind, and in truth really all of our mind, and what's left is nothing, we call the ego. But that awareness that we brought with us into the dream that connects us back to that deeper understanding, we call the Holy Spirit, and that gives us a glowing thread out of the cavernous labyrinth of our dream, and leads us back to the light where we do understand some things, and not just some things, but everything. But here we understand nothing, and we don't certainly understand the conflict, because we think that's all there is. We don't understand that the world that the ego made, there's there's an alternative to that that is beyond polarity and beyond duality. But within duality, we think that's all there is.
Right, and you can't experience... this is the reason that we don't understand that is because we don't experience it as such. We don't experience the world as peaceful. And until we change our mind about it, we can't. And until... It's like, when your child thinks that there's a monster in the closet. And, you know, you can just tell them, go back to sleep, there's no monster. You know, don't be silly, there's no monster. You know, but until you go and turn on the light and look in the closet with the child and look in every corner of the closet and reassure them that there's not possible for there to be any monster in there, and his imagination changes from imagining scary things to then recognizing clothes and you know, shoes and things in the closet instead of monsters, you know, he replaced that belief or that idea with something that is less fearful, you know, clothes instead of monsters, still equally imaginary, and yet it makes them happier that he's not, you know, thinking that some terrible thing is going to come and get him. But, you're going to believe that monster's there. And even sometimes after you've looked through the closet and turned on the light and looked at everything, you're still going to come up with the idea, oh, there's a monster in there. Because that's how ego knows it scared you once, it's going to keep doing it. But once you... Once you recognize, as I do, you know, I recognize there's no monsters in any closets here. You know, there's no monsters in any closets in the world. The difference between a 5-year-old Lynn and a 65-year-old Lynn is experience. I've experienced multitudes of closets and have not once found a monster. But
so now all monsters are sophisticated.
That's right.
Not the obvious one. They're more subtle.
They're subtle. Yeah, exactly. But I can exactly do the same thing. I can exactly do the same thing. Look at those monsters with an objective mind and recognize that they don't really exist there either. And and this is where the idea, you know, I know there's a monster in my closet and I know it's going to hurt me. I know for certain there's no monsters in any closets ever, anywhere. I'm still not sure, come to think of it.
Well, the silly, seemingly separate selves that we think we are never sure about anything because they're based on an uncertain reality, which is essentially nothing. We made it something that's very convincing because it's, you know, a photorealistic... multi-million-year cosmically deep holographic dream, but it's just a dream. But boy, what a convincing dream! You know, put all those special effects houses of all the movie studios in the world to shame because you know we did a heck of a job making up this thing, but it's a dream. And both modern physics and ancient mystics and now, of course, in miracles and other pure non-dual teachings tell us the same story. It's like, you know, don't get taken in by, don't be fooled by this. And if you do, just forgive yourself and, you know, see, you know, hit the mental reset button and say, okay, let's listen to the Holy Spirit's translation again and avoid the pitfalls next time. And hopefully each time a little quicker so that, you know, as those thoughts arise that relate to a fearful identity and a guilty, sinful identity, we can just say, you know, that's just part of a really incredibly whacked out dream.
Exactly. So you want me to read?
I think I still have a little bit left of that paragraph to read.
Okay,
so,
all right.
So why don't I just start that paragraph over because I think it helps.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, you haven't even started. Okay, all right.
Okay. You cannot understand the conflict until you fully understand the basic fact that the ego cannot know anything. The Holy Spirit does not speak first, but he always answers. The ego cannot hear the Holy Spirit, but it does believe that part of the mind, the decision maker, in brackets, that made it is against it. And in our sane moments, it's not so much against it, it just says, why would I go there? There's nothing there. It interprets this as a justification for attacking its maker. This is the ego making this justification. It believes that the best defense is attack and wants you to believe it. And I think this really ties in beautifully to the concept mentioned briefly a few paragraphs down, and I think it's lesson 136, about the double shield of oblivion, and that Ken Wapner goes into in great depth in several of his talks. And the idea behind that, which I find really helpful, is that the inner and the outer shields of oblivion are the two defenses, the double layers defense that the ego uses to keep us mindless. The first being the world is because we've made up this incredibly convincing holographic 3D animated movie, you know, with the cast of characters in the gazillions, trillions of quadrillions of quintillions of things and issues and never-ending stuff to be a firefighter, to try to, you know, get under control and try to manage an unmanageable dream. It keeps us pretty damn busy, literally all the time. If we believe it, if we think that's a real deal. And so that outer shield of oblivion is really just a smokescreen that says, you know, don't go there. When we get close to looking at the contents of our mind, that's when the ego gets really panicky. And of course, says, you know, at this point, it's no longer pretending to be your friend, and pulls out all the stops and yanks down all the fire alarms and in the building and mounts its best defenses, and then the inner shield of oblivion is just stay away from the mind, don't go there, because it is convinced that there is something to unconscious guilt, but it's unfounded. And it's that's the unconscious, unfounded guilt is especially what the ego does not want us to look at. It's unconscious until we look at it, but when we look at it, and when we look at it with the Holy Spirit, we realize it's unfounded. There's no basis for it. You know, the ego's jurisdiction is a fraudulent one, and the Holy Spirit just, you know, throws it out of court because it's like, this doesn't fit reality. This does not fit your eternal being. These personas and bodies that come and go, yeah, they do all kinds of crazy things. And, you know, they build jails to put each other in, and they have kangaroo courts to decide that, you know, some are guilty and some are innocent. And that's just the formal condemnations, the informal ones that really contain just about every aspect of our society, where we pass judgments, some shared public and some just in the quote-unquote privacy of our seemingly separate minds. Those condemnations and imprisonments are taking place all the time, and that's, you know, ego does not want us to look at our, have us be looking at our thoughts and seeing what a desert wasteland it is. And so that's why that inner shield of oblivion is, you know, don't go anywhere near your mind, and certainly not with this Holy Spirit thing I've heard of, but I don't have no idea what it is because it's totally... There's no way that ego and the Holy Spirit can share thoughts because they're completely independent thought systems. So it just no... And I think that's where one of Ken's brilliant points is that the ego is not afraid of the truth because it has no idea what the truth is. It's afraid of the mind's decision to go there, to say, I want not untruth. I don't want the lie. I don't want the ego's assessment of me and its identification with a fake self that's limited to a specific body and its persona, or vice versa. And it's just like, well, why would I want to limit myself to that? Why would I want to condemn myself to such a tiny, you know, droplet wannabe in an ocean of true peace that's available for all of us at any moment.
Wow, yes. And so you speak about that true peace, and you speak about that, the experience that what this course is all about is to bring us to that experience, I believe. It's been my experience that's where I'm going. And so when you have that experience. And this is why we do these exercises. This is why we do this work, is because without the experience of the holy instant, as Jesus calls it, without the experience of that being in the heart of God, or being in the well of peace or whatever, without that experience, you have nothing to keep you going, really. You know, you just have a hope and an idea and a thought that this can happen. But once you start having these experiences where you're actually knowing what it is to be in peace, when you question, and again, this is why the Byron Katie work is so helpful, I think, because yes, you ask the question, is it true? And if you believe, if you say yes, it is true, then you do ask the question, you know, how do you know? How do you know that this is true? And when I start questioning the how do I know, and recognizing that all the pointers and indicators that I have in my life are, you know, they're all broken, and they're not pointing at anything real or true at all. And, you know, the more I question, you know, how do I know that what I believe is true, the more I recognize that I don't know that what I believe is true. And then I can be open. If I can accept that, then I can be open for the Holy Spirit to shift my thinking, to show me the truth. And, you know, then you can ask those other questions, and especially the questions where, you know, when you go and you turn around the accusations or the thoughts about what you thought the world was, and you point to yourself and say, you know, I'm the one who's believing this, and why, or whatever, you actually begin to see the world starts falling apart, the house of cards starts falling apart, and you see that, you know, it's just only, you know, it's only cards. It's not anything really real at all. And in that same moment, the experience is replaced with an experience of light, wholeness, joy, acceptance. There, the Holy Spirit will replace that that broken part with something that is useful and helpful. And as you begin experiencing more and more of what I call peace, through, you know, just recognizing that your thoughts don't have any effect on you, as you begin experiencing that peace, then you have motivation to continue searching for that peace.
Exactly. I think that's such an important point too, because that peace that we get glimpses of is so profoundly, I'm going to use an ego word, better than anything the ego can deliver, because it's not a comparative thing, it's an all-encompassing thing. That, you know, once we really get a taste of that, you know, more and more we realize, well, why would I want to deal with the comparative stuff when it really doesn't deliver? It really doesn't truly satisfy the longing that everyone's heart really has for that unchanging peace and that consistent, eternal quality that truly honors everyone and everything in a way that the fickle, whimsical, silly, made-up selves that we, you know, believe ourselves to be could never do.
So. Exactly. So how about if I read on?
Please do.
Okay, another extremely important passage also highlights the ego's fear of the son separating himself from the ego and returning to the decision-making part of his mind. From that place outside the ego's insanity, what is later referred to as being, quote unquote, above the battleground, that's from text chapter 23, section 4, the son can now objectively evaluate his prior choice. So we get above the battleground, and then I'm going to read, this is a quote from A Course in Miracles, "You cannot evaluate an insane belief system from within it. Its range precludes this. You can only go beyond it, look back from a point where sanity exists, and see the contrast. That's what we're just talking about. Only by this contrast can insanity be judged as insane. With the grandeur of God in you, you have chosen to be little and to lament your littleness. Within a system that dictated this choice, the lament is inevitable. Your littleness is taken for granted there, and you do not ask, who granted it? I love that. Who did this? That's like I listened to Jacob Glass, and he's talking about Terry Cole Whitaker, and someone said to her, I can't afford this because I'm on a fixed income. And she said to the person, who fixed it? Who did this?
That's good. That's good.
Who granted this? Who fixed it? Who fixed that and made it so little? The question is meaningless within the ego's thought system because it would open the whole thought system to question. Bingo. I have said that the ego does not know what a real question is. Lack of knowledge of any kind is always associated with unwillingness to know, and this produces a total lack of knowledge, simply because knowledge is total. Not to question your littleness, therefore, is to deny all knowledge and keep the ego's whole thought system intact. You cannot retain part of a thought system because it can be questioned only at its foundation. And this must be questioned from beyond it because within it, its foundation does stand. Right? In the ego world, it works. So you have to get outside to look at it to say, oh, I see why that doesn't those things don't come together. So the Holy Spirit judges against the reality of the ego's thought system merely because he knows its foundation is not true. Therefore, nothing that arises from it means anything. He judges every belief you hold in terms of where it comes from. If it comes from God, he knows it to be true. If it does not, he knows that it is meaningless. And my meaningless thoughts are showing me a meaningless world.
And that can be upsetting.
That can be upsetting.
If we're not thinking clearly. You know that sentence you read about, you can't question it from within it because, you know, within it, its foundation stands. Well, I was thinking, you know, as you look at the astronaut, you know, the NASA footage of, you know, the space program over the last half a century, I guess. And you look at the farther you get away from the Earth, metaphorically, I suppose, the more all the distinguishing features that separate certain geographic regions from one another disappear. And all the man-made things at some point, you know, are gone. All the stuff we made up is invisible and irrelevant zooming far enough back from the Earth. Like when the Apollo astronauts were walking on the moon and looking back at the Earth, they didn't see the Brooklyn Bridge or the Great Pyramid or even the Great Wall of China. All those imaginary things and barriers and boundaries and, you know, colors on the map that we learned in grade school, they're not there. I mean, those are just mental things that really, if we back up far enough from the entire universe of space-time, which is what the Course in Miracles is an even far nobler, exalted purpose suggesting, we don't see the world at all as being relevant. The entire cosmos of space and time is really just an incredibly elaborate hoax. It's just an unbelievably fantastic dream that we can afford to look at with gentle amusement rather than stark terror. But that takes a lot of practice. I mean, we have to really train our mind to just notice all the things we react to, and all the little petty things down here on Earth, you know, away from, you know, the NASA, photography, you know, would tend to help us believe otherwise about the things that we think are such big deals. Huh?
Exactly, and it just, you're making me think about that Bette Midler song, From a Distance, there is harmony. You know, I mean, really, that's what it is. It's the farther you get back, the above the battleground, as Jesus tells us, you begin to see that everything moves together, everything flows together, and everything is just in perfect harmony. It doesn't appear that way because of my meaning that I've given to everything. So, you know, I've given the meaning to everything that, you know, America is a country. And if you go to the moon and you look down at the world, you don't see a country called America. It's not like a Rand McNally map or anything. You're actually just seeing, you know, big pieces of land and big pieces of water and, you know, clouds and things. You don't see the individuals and their lives and all the hope and all the fear, and you don't see any of those things. Everything is moving in harmony from that distance, and that's really what Jesus is asking us to do, is to just get back, step back, and look at it differently. And you know, once you begin to recognize that, then you actually do begin to see the meaninglessness of each small individual movement, because it all moves together in harmony. You know, no matter what it seems like, it's all moving together in harmony. And even the illusion itself can't be disharmonious. Seen on a small scale, it appears to be, but seeing from above the battleground, that whole story is completely different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. And as you're saying that, I was thinking, you know, the outer space, you know, astronauts' view perspective, I think, is a good metaphor. But also, as our contemporary science would suggest, that we look at, you know, the bigger picture. Also, the smaller picture from in the quantum world, that, you know, the revelation that everything is interconnected and or entangled, as the quantum entanglement phrase suggests. I think I mentioned a few months ago watching a video where, you know, the researchers to places like Microsoft and IBM are doing quantum computing experiments where they've taken quantum bits, which are the quantum equivalents to you know, the digital bits that make up our electronic technology, and they can synchronize them so that the data that is in one is exactly and always the same as the data in another. And so that's the quantum entanglement. It's not just a, you know, a theory that's been proven with isolated particles in the lab. Now they can actually use it for, you know, a computing process to, and so you can have two qubits that are separated not just by a few feet, but by, they could be in separate galaxies, and they would instantaneously, not at the speed of light or a gazillion times the speed of light, but instantaneously have the same data, which to me is like a staggering thing, because it appears to defy what we think of as the laws of physics and space and time and all that stuff. But actually, our modern physics really embraces that. It's a pretty, you know, and the physicists who work with this, you know, one of the famous quotes from, I think it's like Bohr, Heisenberg, Planck, one of those luminaries from a few decades ago said, you know, if something effective, if modern physics, you know, quantum mechanics hasn't shocked you, then you haven't understood it.
Yes, exactly.
Because basically, if we were to zoom into the very small, we would probably discover, oh, well, it's all the same there, too. You know, the differences are only in the middle of the dream, but once we start getting to the edge of our Truman Show, whether it's the very large or the very small, we discover, this is a big hoax. You know, all it takes is a few floodlights crashing down from the ceiling of the soundstage in front of us. This, we start to question things. Wait, what is all this? You know, why am I seeing, you know, these chinks in ego's armor here? Well, it's because we have these moments of peace that give us an inspiration to say, maybe this isn't the real deal here, and that's what, you know, sets the ego on red alert. We start truly questioning its basic premises, its unfounded, unconscious premise that we're a sinful, guilty, fearful, seemingly separate self, but it's all silly.
Yes, and yes, and asking the question is what brings about the peace, actually. Mm-hmm. So it mm-hmm. takes bravery. It takes, you know, you have to be really, you know, don't start asking, is my world real? Unless you want to get an answer that is, you know, maybe negative, like, no, it's not.
But that's, and it's really a positive in the sense of what we really are. And that's why I think Ken Wapnick's, one of another of his brilliant commentaries on the Course is, it's not a course in yes, it's a course in not no. Because the love and the peace and the true joy that doesn't change, that's beyond the curriculum of A Course in Miracles, really is really beyond the scope of it, which is why it's not a course in love, it's not a course in peace, or it's a course in miracles. And the miracle is really the willingness to, at first, and you know, occasionally, but then over time consistently, choose against the ego's no. choose against the ego's denial of the truth, and then the truth of what we really are just, it reveals itself, because that's all that's left after we stop investing with our identity and our emotional and intellectual energy. So
yeah, absolutely, and I think this next paragraph kind of explains that very thing. So do you want to read, or you want me to read?
Sure. Okay, and finally this paragraph from chapter 12 in the text. The search the ego undertakes is therefore bound to be defeated, and since it also teaches that it is your identification, its guidance leads you to a journey which must end in perceived self-defeat. For the ego cannot love, and in its frantic search for love, it is seeking what it is afraid to find. The search is inevitable because the ego is part of your mind, and because of its source, the ego is not wholly split off, or it could not be believed at all. Sound like a little parasite, isn't it? Like a tick. For it is your mind that believes in it and gives existence to it. Yet it is also your mind that has the power to deny the ego's existence, and you will surely do so when you realize exactly what the journey is on which the ego sets you. You know, when the jig is up, and you can say, hey, you know, okay, ego, I'm onto your tricks here. It's like, okay. And then, you know, and if we recognize that we're going to, you know, experience some backlash, then we don't get blindsided when the ego starts getting retaliated. And just say, oh, okay, so my mind is rebelling and recoiling against that because I invest a lot of stuff here in this self. And, you know, I put a lot of time and energy into this thing, and I'm not going to go without a little fight, says the ego.
Mm-hmm.
but that's because we still secretly, you know, we're still nursing this idea that there's something to be gained here, something, some value, some treasure to be gleaned in a dream, and that ain't so.
You know, and it's so funny. It's something you said. When you said the ego says the jig is up, and I thought about that saying, the jig is up, because it comes from fishing. If you're not aware of that, if you are, then you know,
I'm not.
Speaking to the. Okay, so the jig is a thing that you set up when you set up fishing poles, and you go out and you cast a few lines, and then you have something that you set up so that it will tell you if a fish gets on the hook. You know, mm-hmm. like your bobber will tell you if it's bobbing up
right.
and down. But if you're not paying attention, there's you have set this thing up so that this jig that you made up will flip up when there's a tug on the line.
Okay.
So when the jig is up, then you know that the fish has been caught on the hook. But
uh-huh.
that doesn't mean that you have a fish in your frying pan, because
right.
in order to catch that fish, you must now maneuver it, make sure that it's truly caught, let it run away a little bit, pull it back. I mean, this sounds cruel and horrible, but you know, I'm a fisherman, so, you know, this is what we do. And you're reeling it in, and you're reeling, you're letting it loose a little, and you're reeling it in. So it's fighting and fighting. If it's a big fish, it's going to fight really hard, and you're going to have a lot of interaction with the fish. Sometimes the fish will get off the hook. You know, if you don't play it right, if you don't pull it right, if you don't, you know, do it right, it'll get off the hook and you lose it. And you lose your bait, too. Sometimes you even lose your hook. It might even break the line. You don't know. But it's a struggle. It's a fight to get that fish up onto the shore, up into your net. And then, you know, you're going to be able to, you know, do whatever you want with it. Maybe take the hook out, throw it back. I don't know, you know, what kind of fisher person you are. But maybe not a fisher person at all. But, yeah, when the jig is up, that means the hunt is on. I know, oh, I see the problem. I caught this. Now I must wrestle it to the ground and take me, you know, do what I need to do to catch it.
Yeah.
So
that's the alert in the mind that says, okay, it's time to look at this.
Yeah, right. And so then you have to, you know, chase it down, you know, work it down, mm-hmm. figure out what is the source of this? Where did this come from? Why, you know, this, what Jesus is asking, you know, it says, you know, look at the root of that thought. Find out where it is and root it out. Because if you don't root it out, it will continue to send out more and more lines and, you know, keep you ensnared. So
yeah.
Now I'm in a gardening scenario, from fishing to gardening. Well,
shall I read the next paragraph?
Yes,
for you?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Therefore, it is not the Son's choosing the Holy Spirit that frightens the ego, but rather that the Son's choosing his right mind means that he has chosen against his wrong mind the home of the ego. That, to its great horror, the ego does understand in terms of the inevitable effect of such a choice, its own dissolution. To restate and summarize this important point, to which we shall return later, look, the ego does not understand love, but it does understand that the result of the Son's choosing love and its oneness, returning to its presence, means the end of the ego's dream existence of separation and individuality. And so the ego must now devise a strategy to defeat its enemy, the power of the decision-making mind of God's Son, seeing to it that the Son is never able to exercise this power to change his mind. This strategy constitutes its defense, and, as we shall see presently, the four obstacles to peace become the specific means whereby the ego seeks to protect its individuality and specialness. No more real than the separation they are designed to uphold and protect, these four obstacles nonetheless possess tremendous power within the ego's dream of separation. Without these friends and allies, the ego knows the Son would be able to return to his mind and then would inevitably choose the Holy Spirit's truth of oneness over the ego's illusion of separation and individuality. The ego's defense is actually in two parts, in what in Lesson 136 is referred to as a decision doubly shielded by oblivion, which we were just talking about earlier. That's in paragraph 5 of that lesson. The first part of the thought system of sin, guilt, and fear in the mind, which shields the Son from the Holy Spirit's... The first part is the thought system of sin, guilt, and fear in the mind, which shields the Son from the Holy Spirit's unified love. The second part of the defense is the projection of the thought system of separation, resulting in a physical universe of time and space. This shield protects the Son from the battleground within his terrified mind. The first is referred to in the text as the secret dream, while the second constitutes the dreaming of the world. So, the secret dream, the inner dream, and the outer dream. The dreaming of the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, hey, yay, we got up to an actual next part.
Yeah. That's what I figured might be a good place to get to, so next week we can get into another section.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot in there, too. It's basically saying that, you know, our egos aren't going to give up without a fight. But that's the resistance. And the obstacles, the piece that Ken is going to go into in this entire book, in great detail, all seem to have, you know, some aspect of resistance to it. And it's because we think, you know, insanely, of course, that there's something in the world that is going to do it for us. We think there's something still left on ego's bucket list of things to conquer, things to achieve, things to experience. There's always something that the ego thinks is gonna, be a worthwhile to go after and to continue striving for experience, and that ultimately is proven false. But we need to be patient with ourselves as we oftentimes and very typically, need to go through some of those bucket lists to prove to ourselves that, well, that didn't make me happy. It's kind of like, multiple Christmases and kids eventually catch on that, when they open the toy and then they play with the toy and then they play with the box the toy came in and the toy breaks and both are in the trash and the box and the toy. And then the cycle repeats again. It's like, well, those things come and go and they may seem to have a euphoric benefit for a while and then the excitement wears off and it's like, okay, but where's the real fulfillment? What are we truly here for? What do we really want? And it's really the love that's behind the form, the content of the mind that transcends any specifics. But it takes a while to learn to generalize it, doesn't it?
It does. And making me think about the toys at Christmas and the joy that, obviously not always, but the joy that you feel if you have no expectation, which I grew up, never expecting anything, so I was always really excited when anything, I got a gift or something happened. But it's not sad. It's just the way life is for most people in the world. The idea that what you receive, the joy is the like the Christmas present. You got the gift, you have the joy, and having the joy, that's the experience. It really, and maybe later if you play with the toy and good things happen and your friends come over and it turns out to be something that becomes your favorite thing or whatever it is that is your experience then of the gift. That becomes the thing that it's not even the gift itself; it's the experience of the gift. So, I guess what I'm trying to say is that we ingrain even more of the story through embellishing it with extra experience and extra joy and extra fun. And that's the way this is. You and in fact, it is. We share it. It grows. The more we share the gift of compassion or peace or love or joy that we experience when we take these things to the Holy Spirit and allow our thoughts to be changed about them, which is where we're getting to essentially is. We're going to look at the upsets of the world and the thoughts that we have about them and take them to the Holy Spirit and have that exchange going on. The gift that you receive from that, you become less and less fearful and more confident, or I have anyway, become a lot less fearful and a lot more confident in trusting. And I'm able to share that then. And it becomes even greater to me because I'm able to share it. And other people experience it, and so that's what keeps you coming back. It's the well that keeps you coming back. When forgiveness results in a loss of fear, basically, and a remembering of love, then you want that, and you're going to keep coming back to it. So, the joy of the gift, when you receive it. Continues. It's a gift that keeps on giving. I like that.
Yeah, and the Holy Spirit's gift exchange is actually the one that we all want, where we exchange ego's fraudulent, presence for the truly present awareness that really does fulfill everyone's, wishes beyond wishes that what we really truly want, And we repeatedly in the course, Jesus tells us, give me your stuff. Let's look at this stuff together, and examine without condemnation the contents of the mind. Just watch it without making any kind of, you jerk kind of self-talk. And just notice those thoughts and just say, with compassion, I could see peace instead of this. I don't have to invest in an identity that is demeaning to anyone. Kind of like Mr. Rogers' ethic, if you will, that is documented in that film made about him that I saw recently that I recommend to. And, if we can just see that any kind of condemning thought really is not what we want. And we condemn ourselves to a less than wonderful identity every time we equate ourselves with the dream figures that we're taught to identify with. And there's we don't need to condemn our parents for that, because they're just our proxies, they're our representatives and our actors that we hired, and they're on our mind's payroll, just like we're all on each other's payroll to play out this crazy drama. And so we need to just forgive the playwright in our mind, which is really the one decision-making faculty that made the whole thing up, choreographers and set designers and advertising crew and the whole shebang, and brought the whole thing together as just this colossal dream that we can wake up from, and with true forgiveness.
How it gets
undone.
That is exactly how it gets undone, and so accepting littleness for ourselves or anyone is really not helpful. What is helpful is accepting grandeur, accepting looking at your brother and accepting that he is the Christ, and that he is just as holy as I am, and has everything that I have. And if I see my brother in a small way, that indicates to me what I'm thinking about myself. You can't see in anyone else what you don't see in yourself. So
exactly.
All the reflection that I have when I look out at a brother, and I may look at a brother who appears to be a terrible tyrant and see, oh, I'm a terrible tyrant. Going back to that Byron Katie stuff, because when you get to the turnaround where you say, I'm a terrible tyrant, or I have been, or I, you start looking at your own contribution to that thought system, and, you can actually step back from that and actually forgive the world that you see, because it is a dream, and it's silly, as Ken likes to say.
It is, and if we are to, with a little alliteration to close out our hour, if we're concerned about identifying with the terrible two tyrant of the tyrannical ego, I would suggest visiting acim.org and then tap the ticker text to take today's tutorial, and then you'll be able to read today's workbook lesson and meditate on that.
I love it. I love you, Bruce. I do. I just adore you.
Likewise. I will be leaving either this afternoon or tomorrow morning early to go to California, so I'll probably be talking to you from California, but you won't see any difference on the screen.
Because you'll be exactly where you are, which is right now in my mind.
It's just the hair will appear different, only in a dream.
That's right. How funny. I love it.
So have a great week, all.
All right, beloved.
You can find me on acimblog.com and the Facebook channel, the same name. And I know there's lots of places where people can find you online, Lynn, too.
Absolutely. Too many places.
Girl. Have
all
a great
right,
weekend.
See you next week. And I'll turn the mic over to Carrie and Iris. So